Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg, and once again, Carl is joining. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Fred.
So Carl Carlson and I have talked about reliability topics, I think, separately for, 20, 30 years?
30 plus.
And then we met a few years ago at RAMS and recognized a kindred spirit, I think is the appropriate terms. We had different paths to in our careers that paralleled in many different ways. And we decided to, what one thing came out of that initial discussion was we now do a tutorial at RAMS that's on reliability engineering management. And we have a lot of fun with that. But one of the things that we did throughout our careers, and I think you more so than I did, because I steadfastly avoided being a manager, was recognizing and developing reliability talent within the organization. So I did a lot of support structures, a lot of training, and work with engineers and help people find good talent to bring onto their team to develop, say, an electrical engineer into a reliability engineer, those kinds of things. But Carl, I recognize that it's a taint on your record, but you were a manager.
Yes. I know. I try to overcome it, but it's kind of stuck with me.
But you've hired reliability engineers, right?
Yeah.
So in the last episode, we talked about how do you know if you, as a reliability engineer, are good? How do you recognize your own competency? That same question comes into mind when you're trying to hire somebody. So let's turn the table and say, now we're putting up a job description. We want a classic reliability engineer, whatever that may be, and we get a bunch of applicants. How do we know in the interview process, reviewing the resume, talking to them on the phone, that they're going to be all those good things we talked about in the last episode? They're technically capable, they have good business and people skills, they contribute and add value, all those kinds of things. How do you pick that person?
Yeah, that's a challenging topic. I'll provide a little bit of insight here because I've hired many, many reliability engineers over the years. I've also developed many. And so as a manager, I would, from time to time, I would work on developing reliability engineers within a company. And other times I'd go out to universities to master's programs or PhD programs or even bachelor's programs and say, what do we do in terms of hiring? What do we look for? So let me do those in the sequence. Start with the hiring first. Mm-hmm. What I look for is the balance of solid fundamentals of engineering, balanced with a knowledge of certain aspects of reliability engineering, balanced with reasonably good people skills. Now that is a stiff challenge. So you don't always get all three. You might have someone who has a really good engineering background and they've had some courses in reliability, so maybe they don't have all the skills of reliability. The question that I have to look at is, can I then teach them the skills of reliability that sort of fills in those gaps? Mm-hmm. And then based on the interview, I can assess people skills. So the question becomes, is there a certain threshold of people skills that are important? Which ones are more important than others? And can I fill in the gaps by teaching on the job instruction, that type of thing? So I'm really looking for all three, but I don't always achieve all three. The one I cannot compromise is a solid understanding of engineering fundamentals. In other words, I wouldn't want to hire, in my opinion, someone who doesn't have a knowledge of engineering, let's say they're a business person who then took some reliability courses and maybe they understand reliability statistics, that would be difficult because you can't do on-the-job training of engineering fundamentals.
It's very true. I remember an interview question that I got when I was becoming a design for a manufacturing engineer, which had many aspects overlap with reliability, was just a screening question they asked all of their engineering applicants is, what are the four ways temperature or four ways that heat moves? That takes me back to thermodynamics. Yeah. Do you know them all?
I don't think I can. I think I might be able to get three of them right now just floating around in my head, but no, that's good.
And when I went back and I mentioned that question to the engineer that asked me that, I said, why do you ask that question? It's kind of a basic. He said, one of it is, are you familiar with those engineering principles that heat does move, convection, conduction, radiation? And I'm drawing a blank on the fourth one. And I think I did then too. Mm-hmm. He said, but we will ask questions on and deeper technology subjects that no one, the purpose is to find the limit or what you know and don't know and are readily versed with. But also, what happens when you don't know? Mm-hmm. Right? Do you make it up? Do you admit failure? Do you say, well, I'll look it up and go, I'll find it and tell you later? How do you respond when you hit your limit? Was the other part of that question.
Yeah, very good. Very good. So the interviewing, let me give some insight to listeners on the interview process, because it may seem random at times, but it isn't. What we try to do in the interviewing process is to assess not just the knowledge of the person, but how they would apply that knowledge, what experiences they've had in application of knowledge. And we used to, back then we used the STAR system. You can look that up. You can Google it, STAR interview system, where S stands for situations, T for tasks, A for actions, and R for responses. So we posed different situations that someone could accomplish. And so based on the situations, and then we take them through and we have them tell us where have they had situations like that, what were some of the tasks that they accomplished, what actions did they take, and then what were the responses, the end results. So it gets people thinking about not just the knowledge that they have, but how they've applied the knowledge. So I would encourage people, if you are looking to get hired in a different company, or you're looking to get hired in a different department, to be reflecting on how you've applied things in your past and how you've faced different challenges. I also suggest that people practice I'll call it the elevator speech, mm-hmm. which is in 2 minutes or less, why should you be hired? What value do you bring? And by the 2 minutes, I mean, what is the essence of what you bring? What is your value?
Right.
What can you contribute to this effort? The other part that I think is important for an aspiring person who's aspiring to get hired is to do their research on the company that they're interviewing. It is always beneficial if you understand what the problems are that a company is facing. So in this case, if you can anticipate the types of problems that a reliability department in company X would be facing, then you can then characterize your experience as how you can solve those problems. Mm-hmm. And that's really a good entrance point into discussions.
If nothing else, it's how would you use, what experience are you bringing to the table that would help you approach that problem? You might not have the solution. I've often thought that somebody in an interview was trying to get the solution from me and they had no intention of hiring.
Yes.
I don't think that happens all that often, but I would rather hire somebody that has the ability to respond to a situation with, well, here's my approach, and here's how I'll know if it's a good approach or not. It's not just pull out the formula and turn the crank. It's, this is likely the best formula to use or approach to use or tool to use, and here's how I'll know and adjust as I go on. It's that and part that I tended to look for with folks.
Yeah.
And that's hard to teach. I think it goes back to what we talked about last time, is it comes with that curiosity and passion and ability and willingness to learn. I would never hire somebody that came in and says, well, I know how to solve all that. Trust me.
Yeah, I know everything there is to know.
Right. No, it's not going to happen.
No,
it's not going to happen.
A certain amount of humility is important, but on the other hand, a certain amount of confidence is important. It's a balance. You know, building on what we were talking about in the last episode, the importance of the technical skills, the importance of the people skills, the importance of a business savvy. Mm-hmm. I would encourage every reliability engineer to be working on those at constantly. In other words, if you're really good at the fundamentals, great, but you can still be learning, attending conferences or reading about fundamental applications.
Oh, listening to podcasts.
Listening to podcasts, exactly. and now, if you're not so good on people skills, and frankly, the nature of reliability engineering is there are a lot of people who have entered the field and gotten educated, but are not necessarily at the highest level of skilled on people and social skills, and that's fine. So you recognize, I'll call it a gap or a potential. Those can be worked on. Those are not inherent God-given skills. You can actually develop people's skills. And so I would encourage people to read about how to present, how to interact, how to work with teams, how to lead teams. There's a great amount of literature on that subject. And so I strongly encourage people to recognize where there's any potential for improvement and be as industrious on improving the people skills as you are on improving the technical skills.
You gave me a little shudder there, attending RAMs and watching presentations, and you know, yeah, there's a lot of room for improvement there.
I was trying to be kind on that.
Even experience senior professors and senior lecturers and stuff is, I mean, as a counterexample of what not to do is this. This noted professor in a major university reliability program was holding a seminar and he was talking about a particular subject that he obviously knew a lot about. And somebody stood up and said, "Professor, blah, 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 here's a question." And he looked at him for a second and goes, "Well, that's just a stupid question. I'm not going to answer that."
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, geez, I'm glad I didn't answer that. Yeah, I'm glad I didn't ask that question. Plus, I'm not asking a question because I thought it was actually pretty good. I wanted to know the answer. Yeah. And I was like, okay. He didn't get any more questions for the rest of the seminar. Nobody was willing to dive into that nest. So.
Yeah. This another aspect to this conversation about the people side of it is the subject of introvert and extrovert.
Mm-hmm.
The people think the extrovert is good at is naturally good at people skills. Yeah, maybe sometimes not. Sometimes the extrovert is just good at talking, not necessarily good at social interaction. And then people think the introvert is somehow has a deficit on people skills. Well, maybe, maybe not. The introvert tends to think more. The extrovert tends to talk more.
But and I think I wouldn't classify it that way. I think those terms is where the person draws their energy. You know, so if I'm in a crowd of people, for me, it's draining. That's a work.
Mm-hmm.
Yet you can do it and you can have interactions and listen and do all kinds of good things. But the person that's classified an extrovert, comes out of a meeting with other people energized. That gives them energy. And so I think it's not whether a person talks or not, although I agree there's a correlation. Introverts tend to be more intuitive and think about before they speak. But that's, I think, parallel, a corollary to it. But the outward presentation of a person, in, especially in an interview. So if a company is looking at somebody, I'm not so worried if they pick their words. They're in a stressful situation and they want to present their best face. Mm-hmm. But I also don't want them to just ramble on and on and on. Which
exactly right. I completely agree. And that's the point I was getting at, is just the social skills, people skills, does not just mean talking.
Right. It's listening too. Did they, if you ask a question in an interview, I expect them to answer the question, mm-hmm. right? Not dodge or give me a political answer where they you don't need to know, so I'm not going to tell you. And I want to talk about how great, you know, university life was.
Yeah.
You missed the question. I know that, and you've probably have done this, is where you deliberately ask a two-part question or a three-part question. Can they organize an answer that addresses the multiple parts?
Right. Right. Can they think in a logical sequence? And another suggestion that for listeners that are going to be doing interviews either within a company or with a different company is the value of videotaping. I think it really is helpful, or role playing, where you have a friend essentially becomes the camera in the role playing and practicing. I still, to this day, if I have a new presentation to give or I'm going to be in a new situation, I will practice. So there's nothing wrong with practicing an interview.
That's true. And, you know, it's sage advice. And I know that you've made me practice our tutorial over and over. Every year we go through a practice of that to make sure we got our timing right, we what topics we want to build off each other. And every time we make it, it gets better.
Yes.
I agree. But... yeah, it's, I think the key part there, and it goes back to this notion that, I'm drawing a complete blank on his name, the 10,000 hour to be an expert concept.
That's not hitting me either, Fred.
Okay, well, we'll have to, hopefully one of the listeners will remember it. But this idea is that there was a big stir in literature about all it takes is practice. Well, that's not necessarily true. It's you need to have feedback. The best athletes, the best performers, the best musicians, they get very specific, meaningful, and useful feedback as they go through the process. So doing the university experience of taking a class, if you only get a midterm and a final, and that's the sum of your feedback on the class, you don't really learn as much as the ongoing discussion and challenge and back and forth and Q&A type sessions, that if that's an integral part of the course, the chances are that you will walk away with that course with a much deeper understanding because you've had all of these course corrections with every engagement, and the more the better.
Well, and this is a great by Malcolm Gladwell.
Malcolm Gladwell, right.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's the value. While you were talking, I could be multitasking.
Yeah. Well, and it's not his idea. He was picking up on some research on how people become an expert in whatever it is they do.
I think we need to put ourselves in situations that provide feedback. I draw on my FMEA experience here, where I teach FMEA. And a person goes through the class and then they go off into their organization. And if I'm not in touch with that person afterwards, and I try to, they might do a great job of application, or they might have missed something and then they stumble. If they have put themselves in the position of feedback, either by audits or by asking for reviews or colleagues, then that thing they missed will get fixed. And they'll be on the right track. They'll come out of the ditch. If people are flawed, people have blind spots, and people make mistakes. We're all human. And if we don't have that feedback situation, if we don't put ourselves in that situation, then we're not really learning very well. So that's part of the equation and the thing that I look for in hiring, to bring it back to the hiring reliability mm-hmm. engineers. I look for people that are on that path of growth and improvement and know how to correct a mistake. I'm not looking for people that are perfect, because nobody is.
Yeah, it's probably a one-question interview. So tell me about a mistake and what you did about it.
Yeah. That's one to practice.
Yeah, I remember interviewing people at a factory when I was a plant supervisor. And we would always ask the question, so if the batch of material you're working on is done and there's nothing in your queue, what would you do? You know, we're paying you by the hour. You know, it was kind of the notion of, we're paying these people by the hour and we don't want them just standing around. You know, will they maintain the equipment? Will they go look for more work? Will they go help somebody else? You know, what's their approach? And this one guy, he said, well, I always carry my trumpet with me, so I'd practice a few bars.
Oh, my goodness. I wouldn't have anticipated that.
No, you never know what you're going to get. A little bit of practice might have helped him a little bit.
Yeah, I think so.
But, part of what we look for is a competent person. And it takes the variety of different skills that we just talked about and outlined and talked about it a bit in the last episode that we recorded. The idea is if it's not just that I know what an FMEA is and when to apply it, is if I've done an FMEA, what went well, what didn't go well, and how did I learn from that experience?
Yes.
It is kind of the way we circled around and got to that point, is that we're looking for people that are still learning, that are willing to learn, that are active in getting better. And I think that can come out in the interview. I would much rather hire the person that can ask good questions, that's curious and has a passion for being a reliability engineer, than somebody that simply passed the CRE exam and leads with that.
That's a good summary, Fred.
All right. Well, let's leave it there. And, if you're looking for more work in reliability engineering or you're hiring, what do you think? You know, did Carl and I hit on the right concepts, or do we miss anything? So let us know, reliability.fm, and you can find the episode and comment fields there, or you could send us a note through LinkedIn or email or whatever format you're interested in. We are getting some feedback. We're, I think, well over 10,000 downloads on the show, with a little over 100 listens per show. So we know you're out there. let us know what you think. It really makes it makes our day that you cared enough and took the time to give us some feedback. But more importantly, is we'd like the show to help you continue to learn. And based on what we can provide, a lot of times it's enhanced by focusing on what you would particularly like to learn about. So with that, Carl, we'll wrap this one up. I think our 100th episode is coming out in a couple of weeks. And if I can get the editing all put together. But it's been a lot of fun. And thanks a lot, Carl, for participating. And I look forward to getting you seated here again with a cup of coffee. And we'll do it again. We got plenty of other topics.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Carl.
Thanks, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.